Our second reading is from Mark chapter 15. We're reading verses 33 to 39, which you can find on page 1022 of the Church Bibles. Mark 15, starting at verse 33. At noon, darkness came over the whole land until 3 in the afternoon. And at 3 in the afternoon, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" When some of those standing near heard this, they said, "Listen, he's calling Elijah." Someone ran, filled a sponge with water, and put it on a staff, and offered it to Jesus to drink. "Now leave him alone. Let's see if Elijah comes to take him down," he said. With a loud cry, Jesus breathed his last. The curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And when the centurion, who stood there in front of Jesus, saw how he died, he said, "Surely this man was the Son of God." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
It's all about the journey. It's all about the journey. So it's often said. But it's not really, is it? I remember going on a day trip to Hanmer Springs with my parents when I was a young lad, and it was myself or my brothers, and let's go with my brothers, were saying, "How long do we get there? Are we there yet?" You know, the script. And Dad said something like, "We're going to spend longer in the car till at the destination, so you might as well enjoy the journey." He was right, but still, it wasn't all about the journey. It was about the destination too, the glorious warm delights of the hot pools. It was very much about the destination because that's where we were going. Yes, we should enjoy the journey, but it's not all about the journey. It's about the destination as well. And we've been on a long journey through Mark's gospel for a couple of years. The journey itself has been thoroughly worthwhile. It's been an amazing journey. It's been an enjoyable journey. Following Jesus with his disciples, getting to know Jesus, getting to see his wonder. But all the time, we've been heading somewhere. There's been a destination. And we're now reaching it. We've noted a few times in the last few weeks that since chapter 8 of Mark's Gospel, Jesus has been talking about the fact that he would suffer and die. And the next couple of chapters after chapter 8, it became explicitly clear that that was going to happen in Jerusalem and that Jesus was intentionally heading towards Jerusalem. Well, here we are in our passage, on a hill just outside the walls of Jerusalem, and Jesus is facing death. We're at the destination. In fact, Jesus spoke of another part of the destination as well. That's for next week. But we're not only reaching the destination that Jesus has been speaking of, we're also reaching the destination that Mark has been pointing us to from the very beginning of the gospel. With his first words, Mark described his story as the good news about Jesus the Messiah, the Son of God. And last week, Dave helped us to see how Jesus was crowned as the Messiah, God's King, when he was crucified. Well, this week, we come to the other element which Mark has been leading us towards this whole journey, what it really means that Jesus is the Son of God. So, we've asked God's help. Sam asked God's help for us as we do that. So let's jump into it. We're going to take in what Mark has shown us here. We're going to do that in two major parts, each of which has two subparts. The first one, darkness and wrath on the God-forsaken Son. The second one, the way opened by the Son of God. There's an outline in the bulletins there if you want. There'll be things on the screen. First, darkness and wrath. I've got a Bible there. Look with me at verse 33. Verse 33. At noon, Darkness came over the whole land until 3 PM. It's a very strange occurrence, darkness at midday. People have suggested different phenomena that would explain why it happened. Some have said, well, there must have been an eclipse, but it was Passover with a full moon, so that seems unlikely. Some have said maybe it's a dust storm, or there was some other natural phenomena like that. But while that's interesting, it sort of misses the point. The point is when this was happening, or more to the point, what else was going on when this was happening. See, it happened, the darkness came, as Jesus was hanging on the cross. And then the next question is, why did the darkness come at that time when Jesus was hanging on the cross at midday? And the key reason for that seems to be it was a sign of God's judgment, his wrath. See, darkness in the middle of the day is particularly associated with judgment in the Old Testament, in the part of the Bible written before Jesus came. So in the book of Deuteronomy in the Old Testament, God warned the Israelites about what would happen if they turned away from him. And he said, at midday, you will grope about like a blind person in the dark. Midday darkness. The prophet Isaiah describes the exile, which is where the Israelites were judged, where they were sent in judgment for turning away. And Isaiah says, at midday, we stumble as if it were twilight. At midday, it's stumbling like in the dark. And in one of the most famous acts of judgment in the Old Testament, when God judged the Pharaoh in the book of Exodus, one of the climactic plagues is darkness, where it says this, total darkness covered all Egypt, or literally covered the whole land of Egypt for 3 days. Here in Mark, darkness covers the whole land for 3 hours. It's the judgment of God that's happening here. In fact, the prophet Amos looked forward to the great day of judgment, and he said, in that day, declares the sovereign Lord, I will make the sun go down at noon and darken the earth in broad daylight. And he went on to say that it would be a day when he turns religious festivals into mourning, like mourning for an only son. It's as if the land here in Mark's gospel was mourning at the Passover festival, but mourning under the wrath of God. The wrath of God, the judgment of God for sin, for human rebellion against him, for the evil that we do to one another. This day we read of in verse 33, the judgment of God was manifest in the darkness. But who was the judgment upon? Well, verse 34 makes that clear. The judgment was on the God-forsaken Son. Look with me at verse 34. Extraordinary words. And at 3 PM, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, Eloi, Eloi, lema sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? And the darkness had hung over the land for about 3 hours, and Jesus cries out with this heartbreaking cry. It's recorded here in Aramaic, Jesus' mother tongue. It's as if Mark wants us to hear his pain as immediately as possible. And you may have noticed that the words he cried out there, my God, why have you forsaken me, that they're a quote from the first line of Psalm 22, which Luke read for us just before. I remember writing an email about 15 years ago to someone after I read an article they'd written, which I thought was a bit off, the article, and they'd quoted these words from Jesus, my God, why have you forsaken me? And I said Jesus was actually signaling his victory by quoting Psalm 22, and I played down the sense of Jesus being forsaken. Oh, it's not about that. It's about his victory. I was wrong. I was wrong. I do think there is probably a hint at like vindication and victory in that he chose words from this psalm. There's probably a hint. Because often when the Old Testament's quoted, by the New Testament, often it's looking back at that Old Testament passage and the verses around it, which is why it's always good to go and look up a quote in its context in the Old Testament. It's a good thing to do. It's why it's great that we read Psalm 22 just before and heard it in its fullness. So it's good to do that. And that Psalm 22, you probably noticed, has a number of details that connect quite strongly to the scene in the crucifixion. So you might think then that the end of the psalm, where there's vindication, where there's victory, that would be hinted at as well. And that's fair enough. It might be hinted at. But we must not do what I did in that email, and that's miss the reality that Jesus quotes these particular words at this particular moment. At this moment when the wrath of God is on the land. Because in fact, the judgment and wrath of God is upon Jesus. So he is primarily in these words expressing the massive and powerful experience of being God forsaken. But how can that be? Isn't Jesus the Son of God? How can the Son of God be God forsaken? Well, Jesus is the Son of God. And there's a mystery here that I don't pretend to be close to fully understanding. But here, God himself experiences the wrath of God. And in that, he experiences being God forsaken. The perfect one. The one who is all-loving and does not sin and is antithetical, opposed to sin and to all the grief and terror that it causes. Here, he experiences the fullness of sin's consequences as my sin, our sin, all sin is upon his shoulders. He experiences it to a magnitude that no one else will ever fully understand. And above all, he experiences it in that way because here, the Son of God is God forsaken. It's almost too wonderful and terrible to talk about, but there it is in front of us. And verses 35 and 36, which I'll just touch on, they actually re-emphasize this. It seems that those standing around the cross, they kind of misheard Jesus' words as a cry to Elijah. And one of them gives him some wine vinegar, and then they wait and see if Elijah will come and help him. There's a number of things to see in there, which we won't touch on as much today, but one thing we see from this strange incident is that Jesus is alone. There are people standing by, the people near the cross, but at best they see Jesus as a sort of interesting spectacle. A macabre entertainment. And that note there that they have about, well, let's wait and see if it's to save him, that actually rubs it in because no one comes to help. He's forsaken. He's alone. The Son of God is God forsaken. I wonder if you know what it is to feel as if God has forsaken you. As if ultimately you are alone in a cold, dark universe. As Tim said, it might be hard to imagine a cold, dark thing today, but if you're like me, you may have felt that. And one of the times that I've particularly felt like that is when I've particularly sinned. I know that the distance it feels that it creates between me and God. I know that the barrier that sin is makes me feel that distance, like I'm alone. Like the last thing I want to do is look to God at this point when I've done that. And you can feel like you're alone, like you're God forsaken. Jesus, who was sinless, felt God forsaken as he bore the weight of sin. He has felt that feeling. But it's bigger as well. See, our sin, humanity's sin, has left a world that is under the weight of judgment and death because of our sin. And we bear that sense of judgment and death and that God-forsakenness that it feels like at times, even when we haven't done anything particularly wrong. We just live in a universe that is under wrath, that is broken, that is hopeless. At those times we can feel God-forsaken too. I wonder if you know that feeling. Well, in some mysterious way, the Son of God knows this experience. He knows what it is to feel God forsaken, to see only darkness, to be oppressed, to be treated unjustly, to feel the weight of sin and its effects in a broken and often evil world, and to feel alone in that. You know how when you talk to someone who's been through the same thing that you have, there's this connection. Oh, they've been through it too. They get it. They understand. In a vital way, God understands life because the Son has felt God forsaken. Remember that when you do. Remember that when you feel alone. Remember that when it's too much and you feel like you can't even tell if God's there. The Son of God knows that. The Son of God has experienced that. So even in feeling alone, you're not alone. But there's more to this extraordinary destination that we're reaching today. Because next we see the way opened. Look at verse 37 with me. With a loud cry, Jesus breathed his last. Just sit with that for a second. Jesus breathed his last. The one who gave breath, breathed his last breath. This was the moment the Son of God expired. Just before that, he let out a loud cry. That may have been a sign that he was in control still, even at that moment, because a loud cry just before death is very unusual for someone who's crucified. They usually slip away slowly. That's what usually happened. But this wasn't a usual death. It was a real death like we all face. But it was also a very unusual death. It was like no other that has ever happened before or since or will ever happen again. This was the death of the Son of God. In verse 38, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. It's often said that this was a sign of the way being opened up to God, because the temple was the special place of God's dwelling, and this big thick curtain was a barrier to keep out all that was not holy, which compared to God is everybody. So the curtain tearing was a sign that God had opened the way. The way to God was open. And that's right. But there's even a bit more to it. Because throughout Mark's gospel, especially the last chapters, Jesus has often spoken against the temple system, or at least against the way the temple was being used by the religious authorities. Jesus, remember, cleared the temple, went into the courts, and he cleared them out quite aggressively. He pictured the temple and its leaders as a withered fig tree that was dying. And he foretold the temple's destruction in strong terms. Well, here, the curtain ripping is a symbol of the end of the present system of the temple, and certainly an end of the way that it had been corrupted. And through that, the way is indeed open to God. A new and living way, a way that came through the death of Jesus, is opened. As Jesus died, the things that stopped people from coming to God were taken away. The sin that meant we couldn't approach a holy God, that sin has been dealt with. And the human corruption that was keeping people away from God through religious means, that was nullified. The way was open to God. Which means, if you think there is anything stopping you from coming to God, there is not. Nothing that you have done, no sin, no wrong have done, can keep you from God, because Jesus has died and opened the way. And no sense of religious distance, like, oh, I'm not religious enough, or I didn't grow up religious, or I don't understand religion, or I don't get all the symbols. None of that can stop you from coming to God, because the Son of God himself has opened the way. Just come to God. The barriers are down. The way has been opened. And it's been opened by the Son of God. Look at verse 39 with me. And when the centurion who stood there in front of Jesus saw how he died, he said, "Surely this man was the Son of God." Centurion was a member of the Roman army, a commander of 100 soldiers, very likely a battle-hardened, worldly-wise kind of fellow. He would have seen any number of crucifixions. But as he stood opposite Jesus, and he saw the way Jesus died, as he saw the darkness, heard the loud cry, no doubt as he saw Jesus' character and all of this, he knew this was different. So he says, "Surely this man was the Son of God." Now the fact that he was a Roman centurion saying that is significant. Up here is a picture of a denarius, a Roman coin. And the image on it is of Tiberius, the Roman emperor, who was the emperor at the time of Jesus' death. And the inscription on the coin includes the words Divi Filius, Son of the Divine, or Son of God. That was a title for the emperor. So when a Roman soldier, whose highest allegiance was to the emperor, when he calls Jesus the Son of God, he's saying, this man, not the emperor, this man is the Son of God. This crucified man, this man who died a shameful, painful, God-forsaken death, is the Son of God. And the centurion is right. This man is the Son of God. And there are two important things I want to leave us with from that extraordinary truth, that this man on the cross was the Son of God. First one, this is what Mark has meant to show us all along on the journey through the gospel. Back in chapter 1, verse 1, when he said this was the good news of Jesus the Messiah, the Son of God, he was indicating who Jesus was. But what did it mean for him to be the Son of God? Well, throughout the gospel, demons have called Jesus the Son of God, and Jesus has silenced them. People would start to understand that he was something special from God. Jesus was someone special from God, and Jesus would silence them and say, "Don't tell anyone what you've seen." All the way through, there's been this strange caution about Jesus being called the Son of God. Even though Mark said that it was the gospel of the Son of God, there's been this caution about people saying Jesus is the Son of God until now. When this centurion says it plainly and clearly, and Mark wants us to see it clearly as we reach the destination. And that's because if you want to understand what it means for Jesus to be the Son of God, indeed, if you want to truly understand God, you cannot do it without standing right where the centurion was, in front of the cross, looking up at Jesus, seeing him hanging there, weak, shamed, crucified. And that's so different to so many of our expectations. We think of God as mighty, as powerful, as unreachably great. And all of that is true. Indeed, we've seen all of those qualities in Jesus as well as we've gone through Mark's gospel. But we can't properly understand God apart from this man hanging on the cross. For this is the Son of God, there on the cross, dying for us, humbled for us. That is what God is like. One who humbles himself for our sakes. Understand that. See that. Appreciate that if you want to understand God. And live in light of that if you want to live in light of God. That's the first thing. You can't understand God until you stand at the foot of the cross. Second thing. Just realize, this man is the Son of God. Look up and see him there dying. The wrath of God. Who was it? It was the Son of God, who is God himself. It was him who did that for us, for me, for you. Listen to the summary of it all from scholar Peter Bolt. It's a kind of lengthy one, but it is a great summary of this. So have a listen. There, on that cross, God entered into solidarity with us human beings in our suffering. In the person of the Son, God took on flesh and blood and gathered up all our cries of God-forsakenness. And more. He did not simply share our common experience of God-forsakenness in this world under the shadow of death. There on the cross, in the person of the Son, God himself endured God's wrath on our behalf. God himself has done the impossible. God paid the ransom to free us from the judgment of death, and in so doing, he bestowed eternal life on us who are mortal. God poured himself out so that we could be truly free. The Son of God died with us and for us. So stand there with the centurion at the foot of the cross and just wonder. It was the Prince of Glory who died. Did ever such love and sorrow meet? Or thorns compose so rich a crown? It was his dying crimson, the dying crimson of the Son of God, like a robe spread over his body on the tree. And it happened for us. It demands praise. It demands our souls, our lives, our all. And not, by the way, it doesn't demand it because we're guilted into it. You know, like someone's had me over for lunch. I better have them over for lunch to pay them back, or else, you know, it's not. It's not like that. There's no way we could ever pay this back. He didn't do it for that. It demands our soul, our life, our all, and our praise just because it's so wonderful and so beautiful. And so extraordinary. It's just right to serve one such as this, to honor one such as this with all our lives. Isn't it an honor to honor one like that? And isn't it wonderful to be able to love one such as this? This one who was forsaken with us and for us, who died to open the way for us. This one who is the Son of God.